the time.
I won't shut up, Ernie said, coming to face his wife.
You will if you know what's good for you,
Steve warned, balling a fist. Ernie looked at him and swallowed hard. I'm not afraid of you, he said, but it came out as a squeak. Garrett snickered. Steve grabbed Ernie by the front of his shirt, lifting him clear off the ground with one hand as he drew back his ham-like fist. You're going to stop acting like a fool, Milona told him. And you, she turned to Leisha, are coming home with us this instant. She's not going anywhere, Bruna said, setting down her knitting and leaning on her stick as she rose to her feet. The only ones leaving are you three. Shut it, you old witch, Milona said. I won't let you ruin my daughter's life the way you did mine. Bruna snorted. Did I pour palm tea down your throat and force you to open your legs all about town? She asked. Your misery is your own doing. Now get out of my hut. Milona rounded on her. Oh, you'll do what? She challenged. Bruna gave a toothless smile and slammed her stick down in Ilona's foot, bringing a scream from the younger woman's lips. She followed the blow with one to the gut, doubling Ilona over and cutting her outburst short. Here now, Steve cried. Tossing poor Ernie aside, he and Garrett rushed the old woman. Bruna seemed no more concerned than she had at the wood demon's charge. She reached into her shawl and brought forth a fistful of powder, blowing it into the faces of the two men. Garrett and Steve fell to the floor, clutching their faces and screaming. There's more where that came from, Ilona, Bruna said. I'll see you all blind before I take orders in my own home. Ilona scampered for the door on all fours, shielding her face with her arm as she went. Bruna laughed, helping Ilona out the door with a powerful blow to the posterior. Off with you two, she shouted at Garrett and Steve. Out before I set you both afire! The two men fumbled blindly, moaning in pain, their red faces awash in tears. Bruna swatted at them with her stick, guiding them out the door as she would a dog that had peed on the floor. Come back at your peril! Bruna cackled wildly as they ran from her yard. There was another knock later in the day. Leisha was up and about by then, but still weak. What now? Bruna barked. I haven't had this many visitors in one day since my pap sagged. She stopped over to the door, opening it, to find Smit standing there, wringing his hands nervously. Bruna's eyes narrowed as she regarded him. I'm retired, she said. Fetch Darcy. She started to close the door. Wait, please, Smit begged, reaching out to hold the door open. Bruna scowled, and he drew the hand back as if it had been burned. I'm waiting, Bruna said testily. It's Andy, Smit said, referring to one of the men hurt in the attack that week. The wound in his gut started to rot, so Darcy cut him, and now he's passing blood from both ends. Bruna spat on Smit's boots. I told you this would happen, she said. I know, Smit said. You were right, I should have listened. Please, come back, I'll do anything you ask. Bruna grunted. I won't make Andy pay for your stupidity, she said. But I'll hold you at your word. Don't you think for a second I won't? Anything, Smit promised again. Ernie, Bruna barked. That's my herb cloth. Smit here can carry it. You help your daughter along, we're going to town. Leisha leaned on her father's arm as they went. She was afraid she would slow them, but even in her weakened state she could keep pace with Bruna's slow shuffle. I should make you carry me on your back, Bruna grumped to Smit as they went. My old legs aren't as fast as they once were. I'll carry you if you wish, Smit said. Don't be an idiot, Bruna said. Half the village was gathered outside the holy house. There was a general sigh of relief as Bruna appeared, and whispers at the sight of Leisha, with her torn dress and bruises. The crone ignored everyone, shoving people out of the way with her stick and going right inside. Leisha saw Garrett and Steve lying on cots with damp cloth over their eyes and swallowed a smirk. Bruna had explained that the pepper and stinkweed she'd dosed them with would do no permanent damage, but she hoped Darcy hadn't known enough to tell them that. Ilona's eyes shot daggers at her from their side. Bruna went straight to Andy's cot. He was bathed in sweat and stank. His skin was yellowed, and the cloth wrapped around his loins was stained with blood, urine, and feces. Bruna looked at him and spat. Darcy sat nearby. It was clear she'd been crying. "Leisha, unroll the herbs," Bruna ordered. "We have work to do." Darcy rushed over, reaching to take the blanket from Leisha. "I can do that," she said. "You look about to collapse yourself." Leisha pulled the blanket away and shook her head. "It's my place," she replied, untying the blanket and rolling it open to reveal the many pockets of herbs. "Leisha is my apprentice now," Bruna shouted for all to hear. She looked Ilona in the eye as she went on. "Her promising to Garrett is dissolved, and she will serve me for 7 years and a day. Anyone with an ill word to say about that, or her, can heal their own sick." Ilona opened her mouth, but Ernie pointed straight at her. "Shut it," he barked. Ilona's eyes bulged, and she coughed as she swallowed her words. Ernie nodded, and then moved over to Smith. The two men went and spoke quietly in a corner. Leisha lost track of time as she and Bruna worked. Darcy had accidentally cut into Andy's intestine while trying to excise the demon rot, poisoning him with his own filth. Bruna cursed continually as she sought to undo the damage, sending Leisha scurrying to clean instruments, fetch herbs, and mix potions. She taught as she went, explaining Darcy's errors and what she was doing to correct them, and Leisha listened attentively. Finally, they had done all they could and stitched the wound closed, wrapping it in clean bandages. Andy remained drugged into a deep slumber, but he seemed to be breathing easier, and his skin was closer to its normal tone. "Will he be all right?" Smith asked, as Leisha helped Bruna to her feet. "No thanks to you or Darcy," Bruna snapped. "But if he stays right where he is and does exactly as he's told, then this won't be what kills him in the end." As they headed for the door, Bruna walked over to the cots where Garrett and Steve lay. "Take those stupid bandages off your eyes and quit your whining," she snapped. Garrett was the first to comply, squinting in the light. "I can see," he cried. "Of course you can see, you wood-brained idiot," Bruna said. "The town needs someone to move heavy things from place to place, and you can't do that blind." She shook her stick at him. "But you cross me again, and blindness will be the least of your worries." Garrett went pale and nodded. "Good," Bruna said. "Now say true. Did you take Leisha's flower?" Garrett looked around, frightened. Finally, his eyes dropped. "No," he said. "It was a lie." "Speak up, boy," Bruna snapped. "I'm an old woman and my ears aren't what they used to be." Louder, so that everyone could hear, she asked, "Did you take Leisha's flower?" "No," Garrett called, his face flushing even redder than it had from the powder. Whispers spread like fire through the crowd at that. Steve had removed his own bandage by then and slapped his son hard on the back of the head. "There's going to be the core to pay when we get home," he growled. "Not my home," Ernie said. Ilona looked up at him sharply, but Ernie ignored her, pointing his thumb at Smith. "There's a room for the two of you at the inn," he said. "The cost of which you will work off," Smith added, "and you'll be out in a month, even if all you've managed to build in that time is a lean-to."
"Ridiculous," Ilona said. "They can't work for their room and build a house in a month."
"I think you have your own worries," Smith said.
"What do you mean?" Ilona asked.
"He means you have a decision to make," Ernie said. "Either you learn to keep your marriage vows, or I have the tender dissolve it, and you join Steve and Garrett in their lean-to."
"You can't be serious," Ilona said.
"I've never been more," Ernie replied.
The Corps with him, Steve said. Come with me.
Ilona looked at him sideways. To live in a lean-to, she asked. Not likely.
Then you'd best head home, Ernie said. It's going to take you a while to learn your way around the kitchen.
Ilona scowled, and Leisha knew her father's struggle was just beginning. But her mother left as she was told, and that said much for his chances. Ernie kissed his daughter.
I'm proud of you, he said. And I hope one day to make you proud of me as well.
Oh, Da, Leisha said, hugging him.
You have.
Then you'll come home? He asked hopefully.
Leisha looked back at Bruna, then back at him, then shook her head.
Ernie nodded and hugged her again.
I understand.
Chapter 7. Roger. 318 AR.
Roger followed his mother as she swept the inn, his little broom swishing side to side in imitation of her broad strokes. She smiled down at him, ruffling his bright red hair, and he beamed back at her. He was 3 years old.
Sweep behind the firebox, Roger, she said, and he hurried to comply, slapping the bristles into the crevice between the box and wall, sending wood dust and bits of bark flying. His mother swept the results into a neat pile. The door swung open and Roger's father came in, arms full of wood. He trailed bits of bark and dirt as he crossed the room.
Jessam, his mother cried, I just swept in here.
I help sweep, Roger proclaimed loudly.
That's right, his mother agreed. And your father's making a mess.
You want to run out of wood in the night with the Duke and his entourage upstairs? Jessam asked.
His Grace won't be here for a week at least, his mother replied.
Best do the work now while the inn's quiet, Callie, Jessam said. No telling how many courtiers the Duke will bring, running us to and fro like Little Riverbridge was Angiers itself.
If you want to do something useful, Callie said, the wards outside are starting to peel.
Jessam nodded.
I saw, he said. The wood warped in that last cold snap.
Master Piter was supposed to redraw them a week ago, Callie said.
I spoke to him yesterday, Jessam said. He's putting everyone off to work on the bridge, but he says they'll be ready before the Duke comes.
It's not the Duke I'm worried about, Callie said. Piter's only concern may be impressing Rhinebeck in hopes of a royal commission, but I have simpler concerns, like not having my family cored in the night.
All right, Jessam said, holding up his hands. I'll go talk to him again.
I think Piter would know better, Callie went on.
Rhinebeck ain't even our duke.
He's the only one close enough to get help to us if we need it quick, Jessam said. Euchre doesn't care for Riverbridge, as long as messengers get through and taxes come on time.
See the light, Callie said. If Rhinebeck's coming, it's because he's sniffing for taxes, too. We'll be paying from both ends before Roger sees another summer.
What would you have us do? Jessam asked. Anger the Duke a day away for the sake of the one 2 weeks to the north?
I didn't say we should spit in his eye, Callie said. I just don't see why impressing him comes before warding our own homes.
I said I'd go, Jessam said.
So go, Callie said. It's past noon already. And take Roger with you. Maybe that will remind you what's really important.
Jessam swallowed his scowl and squatted before his son. Wanna go see the bridge, Roger? He asked.
Fishing?
Roger asked. He loved to fish off the side of the bridge with his father. Jessam laughed, sweeping Roger into his arms.
Not today, he said. Your mum wants us to have a word with Piter.
He sat Roger up on his shoulders.
Now hold on tight, he said, and Roger held on to his father's head as he ducked out the door. His cheeks were scratchy with stubble.
It wasn't far to the bridge. Riverbridge was small even for a hamlet, just a handful of houses and shops,
the barracks for the men-at-arms who collected tolls, and his parents' inn. Roger waved to the guards as they passed the toll-house, and they waved back. The bridge spanned the dividing river at its narrowest point. Built in generations gone, it had two arches spanning over 300 feet, and was wide enough for a large cart with a horse to either side. A team of Milnese engineers maintained the ropes and supports daily. The messenger road, only road, stretched as far as the eye could see in either direction. Master Piter was at the far end, shouting instructions over the side of the bridge. Roger followed his gaze and saw his apprentices hanging from slings as they warded the underside. "Piter!" Jessam called when they were halfway across the bridge. "Aye, Jessam!" the warder called. Jessam put Roger down as he and Piter shook hands. "Bridge is looking good," Jessam noted. Piter had replaced most of his simpler painted wards with intricate etched calligraphy, lacquered and polished. Piter smiled. "The Duke'll fill his britches when he sees my warding," he proclaimed. Jessam laughed. "Callie's scouring the inn as we speak," he said. "Make the Duke happy and your future set," Piter said. "A word of praise in the right ears, and we could be plying our trades in Angiers, and not this backwater." "This backwater is my home," Jessam said, scowling. "My grandad was born in Riverbridge, and if I have my say, my grandkids will be too." Piter nodded. "No offense meant," he said. "I just miss Angiers." "So go back," Jessam said. "The road is open, and a single night out on the road is no great feat for a warder. You don't need the Duke for that." Piter shook his head. "Angiers is teeming with warders," he said. "I would be just another leaf in the forest. But if I could claim the Duke's favor, it would put a line out my door." "Well, it's my door I'm worried about today," Jessam said. "The wards are peeling off, and Callie don't think they'll last the night. Can you come take a look?" Piter blew out a breath. "I told you yesterday," he began, but Jessam cut him off. "I know what you told me, Piter, but I'm telling you it ain't enough," he said. "I won't have my boys sleeping behind weak wards so you can make the ones on the bridge a bit artier. Can't you just patch them for the night?" Piter spat. "You can do that yourself, Jessam. Just trace the lines. I'll give you paint." "Roger wards better than me, and that's not at all," Jessam said. "I'd make a botch of it. And Callie would kill me if the Corlings didn't." Piter scowled. He was about to reply when there was a shout from down the road. "Aye, Riverbridge!" "Gerald!" Jessam called. Roger looked up in sudden interest, recognizing the messenger's bulky frame. His mouth watered at the sight. Gerald always had a suite for him. Another man rode next to him, a stranger, but his jongleur's motley put the boy at ease. He thought of how the last jongleur had sung and danced and walked upside down on his hands, and he hopped with excitement. Roger loved jongleurs more than anything. "Little Roger, gone and grown another 6 inches," Gerald cried, pulling up his horse and leaping down to pick Roger up. He was tall and built like a rain barrel, with a round face and grizzled beard. Roger had been afraid of him once, with his metal shirt and the demon scar that turned his lower lip into an angry pucker, but no more. He laughed as Gerald tickled him. "Which pocket?" Gerald asked, holding the boy at arm's length. Roger pointed immediately. Gerald always kept the sweets in the same place. The big messenger laughed, retrieving a Risonian sugar wrapped in a twist of corn husk. Roger squealed and plopped down on the grass to unwrap it. "What brings you to Riverbridge this time?" Jessam asked the messenger. The jongleur stepped forward, sweeping his cloak back in a flourish. He was tall, with long hair sun-bleached to gold and a brown beard. His jaw was perfectly squared, and his skin sun-bronzed. Over his motley he wore a fine tabard emblazoned with a cluster of green leaves and a field of brown. "Arik Sweetsong," he introduced himself. "Master jongleur and herald to his grace Duke Rheinbeck III,
guardian of the forest fortress, wearer of the wooden crown, and lord of all Angiers. I come to inspect the town before his grace's arrival next week."
"The Duke's herald is a jongleur?" Piter asked Gerald, raising an eyebrow.
"None better for the hamlets," Gerald replied with a wink. "Folks are less likely to string a man up for telling them taxes are raised when he's juggling for their kids."
Arik scowled at him, but Gerald only laughed.
"Be a good man and fetch the innkeep to come for our horses," Arik told Jessam.
"I'm the innkeep," Roger's father said, holding out his hand.
"Jessam Inn. That's my boy Roger."
He nodded at Roger.
Arik ignored the hand and the boy, producing a silver moon as if from thin air and flicking it his way. Jessam caught the coin, looking at it curiously.
"The horses," Arik said pointedly.
Jessam frowned, but he pocketed the coin and moved for the animals. Gerald took his own reins and waved him away.
"I still need my wards looked at, Piter," Jessam said. "You'll be sorry if I have to send Callie to shriek at you about it."
"It looks like the bridge still needs a lot of work before his grace arrives," Arik noted.
Piter stood a bit straighter at that and gave Jessam a sour look.
"Do you wish to sleep behind peeling wards tonight, Master Jongleur?" Jessam asked.
Arik's bronze skin paled at that.
"I'll take a look at them if you want," Gerald said. "I can patch them if they're not too bad, and I'll fetch Piter myself if they are."
He stopped his spear and gave the warder a hard stare. Piter's eyes widened, and he nodded his understanding.
Gerald picked Roger up and set him atop his huge destrier. "Hold tight, boy," he said. "We're going for a ride."
Roger laughed and pulled the destrier's mane as Gerald and his father led the horses to the inn. Arik strode ahead of them like a man followed by servants. Callie was waiting at the door.
"Gerald," she called. "What a pleasant surprise."
"And who is this?" Arik
asked, his hands flicking quickly to smooth his hair and clothes.
"This is Callie," Jessam said, adding, "My wife," when the twinkle in Arik's eye didn't diminish.
Arik seemed not to hear, striding up to her and throwing his multicolored cloak back as he made a leg.
"A pleasure, madam," he said, kissing her hand. "I am Arik Sweetsong, Master Jongleur and Herald to Duke Rhinebeck III, guardian of the forest fortress, wearer of the wooden crown, and lord of all Angiers. His grace would be pleased to see such beauty when he visits your fine inn."
Callie covered her mouth, her pale cheeks colouring to match her red hair. She made a clumsy curtsy in return.
"You and Gerald must be tired," she said. "Come in and I'll serve some hot soup while I prepare supper."
"We would be delighted, good lady," Arik said, bowing again.
"Gerald promised to look over the wards for us before dark, Cal," Jessam said.
"What?"
Callie asked, pulling her eyes from Arik's handsome smile.
"Oh, well, you two stake the horses and see to that while I show Master Arik a room and start supper," she said.
"A lovely idea," Arik said, offering her an arm as they went inside.
"Keep an eye on Arik with your wife," Gerald muttered. "They call him Sweetsong because his voice will make any woman sweet between the legs, and I've never known him to stop at a wedding vow."
Jessam scowled.
"Roger," he said, pulling him off the horse, "run in and stay with Mum." Roger nodded, hitting the ground running.
"The last jongleur ate fire," Roger said. "Can you eat fire?"
"That I can," Arik said, "and spit it back out like a flame demon."
Roger clapped his hands, and Arik turned back to gaze at Callie, who was bending behind the bar to fill him a mug of ale. She had let her hair down.
Roger pulled his cloak again. The jongleur tried to tuck it out of reach, but Roger just tugged on his pant leg instead.
"What is it?" Arik asked, turning back to him with a scowl. "Do you sing, too?" Roger asked. "I like singing."
"Perhaps I'll sing for you later," Arik said, turning away again.
"Oh, give him a little song," Callie begged, putting a foaming mug on the counter before him. "It would make him so happy."
She smiled, but Eric's eyes had already drifted down to the top button of her dress, which had mysteriously come undone while she fetched his mug.
"Of course," Eric said, smiling brightly. "Just a pull of your fine ale to wash the dust from my throat." He drained the mug in one quaff, eyes never leaving her neckline, and reached for a large multicolored bag on the floor. Callie refilled his mug as he produced his lute.
Eric's rich alto voice filled the room, clear and beautiful as he gently strummed the lute. He sang a song of a hamlet woman who missed her one chance to love a man before he left for the free cities and forever regretted it. Callie and Roger stared at him in wonder, mesmerized by the sound. When he finished, they clapped loudly.
"More!" Roger cried.
"Not now, my boy," Eric said, ruffling his hair. "Perhaps after supper." "Here," he said, reaching into the multicolored bag.
"Why not try making your own music?"
He produced a straw fiddle, several strips of polished rosewood in different lengths set into a lacquered wooden frame. A stout cord attached it to the wand, a 6-inch stick with a lathed wooden ball at the end. "Take this and go and play a bit while I speak with your lovely mother," he said. Roger squealed in delight, taking the toy and running off to plop down on the wooden floor, striking the strips in different patterns, delighting in the clear sounds each made. Callie laughed at the sight.
"He's going to be a jongleur one day," she said.
"Not a lot of custom?" Eric asked, sweeping his hand over the empty tables in the common room.
"Oh, it was crowded enough at lunchtime," Callie said. "But this time of year we don't get many boarders apart from the occasional messenger."
"It must get lonely, tending an empty inn," Eric said.
"Sometimes," Callie said. "But I've Roger to keep me busy. He's a handful even when it's quiet, and a terror during caravan season when the drivers get drunk and sing till all hours, keeping him up with their racket."
"I imagine it must be hard for you to sleep through that, too," Eric said.
"It's hard for me," Callie admitted. "But Jessam can sleep through anything."
"Is that so?" Eric asked, sliding his hand over hers.
Her eyes widened and she stopped breathing, but she didn't pull away.
The front door slammed open.
"Wards are patched," Jessam called.
Callie gasped, snatching her hand away from Eric's so quickly she spilled his ale across the bar. She grabbed a rag to soak it up.
"Just a patch job?" she asked doubtfully,
her eyes down to hide the flush in her cheeks.
"Not by a spear's throw," Gerald said. "Honestly, you're lucky they lasted as long as they did. I patched the worst of them, and I'll have a talk with Piter in the morning. I'll see him replace every ward on this inn before sunset if I have to hold him at spear point."
"Thank you, Gerald," Callie said, casting Jessam a withering look.
"I'm still mucking the barn," Jessam said, "so I stake the horses out in the yard in Gerald's portable circle."
"That's fine," Callie said. "Wash up, all of you. Supper will be ready soon."
"Delicious," Eric proclaimed, drinking copious amounts of ale with his supper. Callie had roasted an herb-crusted shank of lamb, serving the finest cut to the Duke's Herald. "I don't suppose you have a sister as beautiful as yourself," Eric asked between mouthfuls. "His Grace is in the market for a new bride."
"I thought the Duke already had a wife," Callie said,
blushing as she leaned to fill his mug.
"He does," Gerald grunted. "His fourth."
Eric snorted.
"No more fertile than the others, I'm afraid, if the talk around the palace holds true. Rhinebeck will keep seeking wives until one gives him a son."
"You might have the right of that," Gerald admitted.
"How many times will the tenders let him stand and promise the Creator forever?" Jessam asked.
"As many as he needs," Eric assured. "Lord Jansen keeps the holy men in check." Gerald spat. "It's not right. Men of the Creator having to debase themselves for that."
Eric held up a warning finger. They say even the trees have ears for those who speak out against the First Minister. Gerald scowled, but he held his tongue. Well, he's not likely to find a bride in Riverbridge, Jessam said. There ain't even women enough for those of us here. I had to go all the way to Cricket Run to find Callie.
You're Angerian, my dear? Eric asked.
Born, yes, Callie said. But the tender had me swear an oath to Milne at the wedding. All bridge folk are required to swear to Euchre.
For now, Eric said.
So it's true what they say, Jessam said.
Rhinebeck is coming to lay claim to Riverbridge.
Nothing so dramatic, Eric said. His Grace simply feels that with half your people of Angerian stock and your bridge built and maintained from Angerian timber, that we should all have a...
He eyed Callie as she sat back down. Closer relationship.
I doubt Euchre will be quick to share Riverbridge, Jessam said. The dividing has separated their lands for 1,000 years. He'll no sooner yield that border than his own throne.
Eric shrugged and smiled again.
That is a matter for dukes and ministers, he said, raising his mug. Small folk such as us need not concern ourselves over such things.
The sun soon set, and outside there were sharp, crackling retorts, punctuated by flashes of light that leaked through the shutters as wards flared. Roger hated those harsh sounds and the shrieks that came with them. He sat on the floor, striking his noisemaker harder and harder, trying to drown them out.
"Corlings are hungry tonight," his father mused.
"It's upsetting Roger," Callie said, rising from her seat to go to him.
"Not to fear," Eric said, wiping his mouth.
He went to his multicolored bag, pulling out a slim fiddle case.
"We'll drive those demons off."
He put bow to string and immediately filled the room with music. Roger laughed and clapped. His fear vanished. His mother clapped with him, and they found a rhythm to complement Eric's tune. Even Jarl and Jessam began to clap along. "Dance with me, Roger," Callie laughed, taking his hand and pulling him to his feet. Roger tried to keep up as she stepped to the beat, but he stumbled, and she swept him up in her arms, kissing him as she spun around the room. Roger laughed in delight. There was a sudden crash. Eric's bow slipped from the strings as everyone turned to see the heavy wooden door shaking in its frame. Dust, knocked loose by the impact, drifted lazily to the floor. Gerald was the first to react, the big man moving with surprising speed for the spear and shield he had left by the door. For a long moment, the others stared at him, uncomprehending. There was another crash, and thick black talons burst through the wood. Callie shrieked. Jessam leapt to the fireplace, snatching up a heavy iron poker. "Get Roger to the boat hold in the kitchen," he cried, his words punctuated by a roar from beyond the door. Jarl had snatched up his spear by then and threw his shield to Eric. "Get Callie and the boy out," he cried as the door splintered and a 7-foot rock demon burst through. Jarl and Jessam turned to meet it. The creature threw back its head and shrieked as small, nimble flame demons darted into the room around and between its thick legs. Eric caught the shield, but when Callie ran to his protection, Roger clutched in her arms, he shoved her aside, snatching up his multicolored bag and sprinting to the kitchen. "Callie!" Jessam cried as she struck the floor, twisting to shield her son from the impact. "Damn you to the core, Eric!" Gerald cursed the jongleur. "May all your dreams turn to dust!" The rock demon struck him a backhand blow, launching him across the room. A flame demon leapt at her as Callie struggled to her feet, but Jessam struck it hard with the poker, knocking it aside. It coughed fire as it landed, setting the floor alight. "Go!" he cried as she got her feet under her. From over her shoulder, Roger watched the demon spit fire on his father as they fled the room. Jessam screamed as his clothes ignited. His mother clutched him tightly to her breast, moaning as she ran down the hall. Back at the common room, Gerald roared in pain. They burst into the kitchen just as Eric yanked open the trapdoor and dropped down. His hand reached back, slapping around for the heavy iron ring to pull the warded trap shut.
"Master Arik!" Callie cried. "Wait for us!"
"Demon!" Roger screamed as a flame demon scampered into the room, but his warning came too late. The impact, as the calling struck them, knocked the breath from his mother, but she kept hold of him even as the creature's talons dug deep into her. She shrieked as it ran up her back, its razored teeth clamping down on her shoulder and slicing through Roger's right hand. He howled.
"Roger!"
his mother cried, stumbling toward the washing trough before falling to her knees. Screaming in pain, she reached back and got a firm grip on one of the calling's horns.
"You can't have my son!" she screamed, and threw herself forward, pulling on the horn with all her strength.
Torn from its perch, the demon took ribbons of flesh with it as Callie flipped it into the trough. Soaking crockery shattered on impact, and the flame demon gurgled and thrashed, steam filling the air as water was brought to an instant boil. Callie screamed as her arms burned, but she held the creature under until its thrashes stopped.
"Mom!"
Roger cried, and she turned to see two more of the creatures scamper into the room. She grabbed Roger and ran for the trap, yanking the heavy door open with one hand. Arik's wide eyes looked up at her. Callie fell as a flame demon latched onto her leg, taking a bite out of her thigh.
"Take him, please,"
she begged, shoving the boy down into Arik's arms.
"I love you,"
she cried to Roger, and she slammed the trap shut, leaving them in darkness. So close to the dividing river, houses in Riverbridge were built on great warded blocks to resist flooding. They waited in the darkness, safe enough from calling so long as the foundation held, but there was smoke everywhere.
"Die from demons or die from smoke," Arik muttered.
He started to move away from the trap, but Roger clung hard to his leg.
"Let go, boy," Arik said, kicking his leg in an attempt to shake the boy off.
"Don't leave me,"
Roger cried, weeping uncontrollably. Arik frowned. He looked around at the smoke and spat. "Hold tight, boy," he said, putting Roger on his back. He lifted the edges of his cape to seat the boy in a makeshift sling, tying the corners about his waist. He took up Gerald's shield and picked his way through the foundation, crouching to crawl out into the night.
"Creator above," he whispered, as he saw the entire village of Riverbridge in flames.
Demons danced in the night, dragging screaming bodies out to feast.
"Seems your parents weren't the only ones Piter shorted," Arik said. "I hope they dragged that bastard down into the core."
Crouching behind the shield, Arik made his way around the inn, hiding in the smoke and confusion until they made the main courtyard. There, safe in Gerald's portable circle, were the two horses, an island of safety amid the horror. The flame demon caught sight of them as Arik broke into a run for the sucker, but Gerald's shield turned its fire spit with a flare of magic. Inside the circle, Arik dropped Roger and fell to his knees, gasping. When he recovered, he began to dig at the saddlebags desperately.
"It must be here," he muttered. "I know I left..." "Ah."
He pulled a wineskin free and yanked off the stopper, gulping deeply. Roger whimpered, cradling his bloody right hand.
"Eh?" Arik asked. "You hurt, boy?"
He moved over to examine Roger, and gasped when he saw the boy's hand. Roger's middle and index fingers were bitten clear away. His remaining fingers still clutched tightly about a lock of red hair, his mother's, severed by the bite.
"No!"
Roger cried as Arik tried to take the hair away.
"It's mine!"
"I won't take it, boy," Arik said. "I just need to see the bite."
He put the lock in Roger's other hand, and the boy clenched it tightly. The wound wasn't bleeding badly,
partly cauterized by the flame demon's saliva, but it oozed and stank.
"I'm no herb-gatherer," Eric said with a shrug, and squirted it with wine from his skin.
Roger screamed, and Eric tore a bit of his fine cloak to wrap the wound. Roger was crying freely by then, and Eric wrapped him tightly in his cloak.
"There, there, boy," he said, holding him close and stroking his back. "We're alive to tell the tale. That's something, isn't it?"
Roger kept on weeping, and Eric began to sing a lullaby. He sang as Riverbridge burned.
He sang as the demons danced and feasted.
The sound was like a shield around them, and under its protection, Roger gave in to exhaustion and fell asleep.
Chapter 8. To the Free Cities. 319 AR. Arlen leaned more heavily on his walking stick as the fever grew in him. He hunched over and retched, but his empty stomach had only bile to yield. Dizzy, he searched for a focal point. He saw a plume of smoke. There was a structure off the side of the road far ahead, a stone wall so overgrown with vines that it was nearly invisible. The smoke was coming from there. Hope of succor gave strength to his watery limbs, and he stumbled on. He made the wall, leaning against it as he dragged himself along, looking for an entrance. The stone was pitted and cracked, creeping vines threaded into every nook and cranny. Without the vines to support it, the ancient wall might simply collapse, as much as Arlen would without the wall to support him. At last he came to an arch in the wall. Two metal gates, rusted off their hinges, lay before it in the weeds. Time had eaten them away to nothing. The arch opened into a wide courtyard choked with vines and weeds. There was a broken fountain filled with murky rainwater, and a low building so covered in ivy that it could be missed at first glance. Arlen walked around the yard in awe. Beneath the growth, the ground was cracked stone. Full-sized trees had broken through, overturning giant blocks now covered in moss. Arlen could see deep claw marks in the plain stone. No wards, he realized in amazement. This place was from before the return. If that was so, it had been abandoned for over 300 years. The door to the building had rotted away like the gate. A small stone entryway led into a wide room. Wires hung in a tangle from the walls. The art they had held long disintegrated. A coating of slime on the floor was all that remained of a thick carpet. Ancient grooves were clawed into the walls and furniture, remnants of the fall.
"Hello?" Arlen called. "Is anyone here?"
There was no reply. His face felt hot, but he was shivering even in the warm air. He didn't think he could manage to search much further, but there had been smoke, and smoke meant life. The thought gave him strength, and finding a crumbling stairwell, he picked his way to the second floor. Much of the building's top floor was open to sunlight. The roof was cracked and caved in, rusting metal bars jutting from the crumbling stone.
"Is anyone here?" Arlen called.
He searched the floor, but found only rot and ruin. As he was losing hope, he saw the smoke through a window at the far end of the hall. He ran to it, but found only a broken tree limb lying in the rear courtyard. It was clawed and blackened, with small fires still crackling in places, giving off a steady plume. Crestfallen, he felt his face twist, but he refused to cry. He thought about just sitting and waiting for the demons to come, in hopes they would give him a faster death than the sickness, but he had sworn to give them nothing. And besides, Maria's death had certainly not been quick. He looked down from the window to the stone courtyard. A fall from here would kill anyone, he mused. A wave of dizziness washed over him, and it felt easy and right to just let himself fall. "Like Charlie?" a voice in his head asked. The noose flashed in his mind, and Arlen snapped back to reality, catching himself and pulling away from the window.
No, he thought. Charlie's way is no better than Da's. When I die, it will be because something killed me, not because I gave up.
He could see far from the high window, over the wall and down the road. Off in the distance, he spotted movement, coming his way.
Reagan.
Arlen tapped reserves of strength he didn't know he had, bounding down the steps with something approaching his usual alacrity, and running full out through the courtyard. But his breath gave out as he reached the road, and he fell onto the clay, gasping and clutching a stitch in his side. It felt like there were 1,000 splinters in his chest. He looked up and saw the figures still far down the road, but close enough that they saw him, too. He heard a shout as the world went black. Arlen awoke in daylight, lying on his stomach. He took a breath, feeling bandages wrapped tightly around him. His back still ached, but it no longer burned, and for the first time in days, his face felt cool. He put his hands under him to rise, but pain shot through him.
"I wouldn't be in any rush to do that," Reagan advised. "You're lucky to be alive."
"What happened?" Arlen asked, looking up at the man who sat nearby.
"Found you passed out on the road," the man said. "The cuts on your back had demon rot. Had to cut you open and drain the poison before I could sew them up."
"Where's Kieran?" Arlen asked.
Reagan laughed.
"Inside," he said. "Kieran's been keeping his distance the last couple of days. He couldn't handle the gore and sicked up when we first found you."
"Days?" Arlen asked.
He looked around and found himself back in the ancient courtyard. Reagan had made camp there, his portable circles protecting the bedrolls and animals.
"We found you around high sun on third day," Reagan said. "It's fifth day now. You've been delirious the whole time, thrashing around as you sweated out the sickness."
"You cured my demon fever?" Arlen asked in shock.
"That what they call it in the brook?" Reagan asked.
He shrugged. "Good a name as any, I suppose, but it's not some magic disease, boy. It's just an infection. I found some hog root not far off the road, so I was able to poultice the cuts. I'll make some tea with it later. If you drink it for the next few days, you should be all right."
"Hog root?" Arlen asked.
Reagan held up a weed that grew most everywhere.
"A staple of every messenger's herb pouch, though it's best when fresh. Makes you a little dizzy, but for some reason demon rot can't abide it."
Arlen began to cry.
His mother could have been cured by a weed he regularly pulled from Jeff's field? It was just too much. Reagan waited quietly, giving Arlen space while the tears ran their course. After what seemed an eternity, the flow began to ebb, and his heaving sobs eased. Reagan handed him a cloth wordlessly, and Arlen dried his cheeks.
"Arlen," the messenger asked finally, "what are you doing all the way out here?"
Arlen looked at him for a long time, trying to decide what to say. When he finally spoke, the tale came spilling out in a rush. He told the messenger everything, starting with the night his mother was injured, and ending with running from his father. Reagan was quiet while he took in Arlen's tale.
"I'm sorry about your mother, Arlen," he said at last.
Arlen sniffled and nodded. Kieran wandered back as Arlen began telling how he had tried to find the road to Sunny Pasture, but had accidentally taken the fork to the Free Cities instead. He paid rapt attention as Arlen described his first night alone, the giant rock demon, and how he had scuffed the ward. The jongleur went pale when Arlen described the race to repair it before the demon killed him.
"You're the one that cut that demon's arm off?" Reagan asked incredulously a moment later.
Kieran looked ready to sick up again.
"It's not a trick I mean to try again," Arlen said.
"No, I don't suppose it is," Reagan chuckled. "Still, crippling a 15-foot rock demon is a deed worth a song or two, eh, Kieran?"
He elbowed the jongleur, but that seemed to push the man over the edge. He covered his mouth and ran off. Reagan shook his head and sighed. A giant one-armed rock demon's been haunting us ever since we found you, he explained. It's hammered the wards harder than any coiling I've ever seen.
Is he going to be all right? Arlen asked, watching Kieran double over.
It'll pass, Reagan grunted. Let's get some food into you. He helped Arlen sit up against the horse's saddle. The move sent a stab of pain through him, and Reagan saw him wince. Chew on this, he advised, handing Arlen a gnarled root. It'll make you a little light-headed, but it should ease the pain.
Are you an herb-gatherer? Arlen asked.
Reagan laughed. No, but a messenger needs to know a little of every art if he wants to survive. He reached into his saddlebags, pulling out a metal cookpot and some utensils.
I wish you'd told Colleen about Hogroot, Arlen lamented.
I would have, Reagan said, if I thought for a second she didn't know. He filled the pot and hung it from the tripod over the fire pit. It's amazing what people have forgotten. He stoked the flames as Kieran returned, looking pale but relieved. I'll be sure to mention it when we take you back.
Back? Arlen asked.
Back? Kieran echoed.
Of course back, Reagan said. Your Da will be looking for you, Arlen.
But I don't want to go back, Arlen said. I want to go to the Free Cities with you. You can't just run away from your problems, Arlen, Reagan said.
I'm not going back, Arlen said.
You can drag me there, but I'll run again the second you let go. Reagan stared at him for a long time. Finally, he glanced at Kieran.
You know what I think, Kieran said.
I've no desire to add 5 nights at least to our trip home. Reagan frowned at Arlen. I'll be writing your father when we get to Milne, he warned.
You'll be wasting your time, Arlen said. He'll never come for me.
The stone floor of the courtyard and the high wall hid them well that night. A wide, portable circle secured the cart, and the animals were staked and hobbled in another. They were in the inner of 2 concentric rings with the fire at the center. Kieran lay huddled in his bedroll with a blanket over his head. He was shivering, though it wasn't cold, and when the occasional calling tested the wards, he twitched.
Why do they keep attacking when they can't get through? Arlen asked.
They're looking for flaws in the net, Reagan said. You'll never see a Corling attack the same spot twice.
He tapped his temple. They remember.
Corlings aren't smart enough to study the wards and reason out the weak spots, so they attack the barrier and search that way. They get through rarely, but often enough to make it worth their while.
A wind demon came swooping over the wall and bounced off the wards. Kieran whimpered from under his blanket at the sound. Reagan looked over at the jongleur's bedroll and shook his head.
It's like he thinks that if he can't see the Corlings, they can't see him, he muttered.
Is he always like this? Arlen asked.
That one-armed demon has him more spooked than usual, Reagan said. But he wasn't exactly standing at the wards before.
He shrugged.
I needed a jongleur on short notice. The guild gave me Kieran. I don't normally work with one so green.
Why bring a jongleur at all, then? Arlen asked.
Oh, you have to bring a jongleur with you when you're going to the hamlets, Reagan said. They're apt to stone you if you show up without one.
Hamlets?
Small villages, like Tibbetts Brook, Reagan explained. Places too far for the dukes to easily control, where most folks can't read.
What difference does that make? Arlen asked.
People that can't read don't have a lot of use for messengers, Reagan said. Oh, they're eager enough for their salt, or whatever it is that they're shy of, but most won't come out of their way to see you and give you news, and collecting news is a messenger's first job. But bring a jongleur with you, and people drop everything to come and see the spectacle. It wasn't just for you that I spread word of Kieran's show.
Some men, he went on, can be merchant, jongleur, herb-gatherer, and messenger all at once.
But they're about as common as a friendly calling. Most messengers who take the hamlet routes have to hire a jongleur.
And you don't usually work the hamlets, Arlen said, remembering.
Reagan winked. Jongleur may impress the townies, but he'll only hold you back in a duke's court. The dukes and merchant princes have jongleurs of their own. All they're interested in is trade and news, and they pay far more than anything old hog could afford. Regan rose before the sun the next morning. Arlen was already awake, and Regan nodded at him in approval. "Messengers don't have the luxury of sleeping late," he said as he loudly clattered his cook pans to wake Kieran. "Every moment of light is needed." Arlen was feeling well enough by then to sit next to Kieran in the cart as it trundled toward the tiny lumps on the horizon Regan called mountains. To pass the time, Regan told Arlen tales of his travels, and pointed to herbs along the side of the road, saying which to eat and which to avoid, which could poultice a wound and which would make it worse. He noted the most defensible spots to spend a night and why, and warned about predators. "Corlings kill the slowest and weakest animals," Regan said, "so only the biggest and strongest, or those best at hiding, survive. Out on the road, corlings aren't the only thing that will see you as prey." Kieran looked around nervously. "What was that place we stayed in the last few nights?" Arlen asked. Regan shrugged. "Just some minor lord's keep," he said. "There are hundreds of them in the lands between here and Milne. Old ruins picked clean by countless messengers."
"Messengers?" Arlen asked.
"Of course," Regan said. "Some messengers spend weeks hunting for ruins. The ones lucky enough to stumble on ruins no one's ever found can come back with all kinds of loot. Gold, jewels, carvings, sometimes even old wards. But the real prize they're all chasing is the old wards, the fighting wards, if they ever really existed."
"Do you think they existed?" Arlen asked.
Regan nodded. "But I'm not about to risk my neck leaving the road to look for them." After a couple of hours, Regan led them off the road to a small cave. "Always best to ward a shelter when you can," he told Arlen. "This cave is one of the few noted in Greg's log." Regan and Kieran set up camp, feeding and watering the animals and moving their supplies into the cave. The unhitched cart was put in a circle just outside. While they worked, Arlen inspected the portable circle.
"There are wards here I don't know," he noted, tracing the markings with a finger.
"I saw a few in Tibbetts Brook that were new to me as well," Regan admitted. "I copied them down in my log. Perhaps tonight you can tell me what they do."
Arlen smiled, pleased that he might offer something in return for Regan's generosity.
Kieran began shifting uncomfortably as they ate, looking frequently at the darkening sky. But Regan seemed unhurried as the shadows grew. "Best to bring the mollies into the cave now," Regan noted finally. Kieran immediately moved to comply. "Pack animals hate caves," Regan told Arlen. "So you wait as long as you can before bringing them in. The horse always goes last."
"Does it have a name?" Arlen asked.
Regan shook his head. "My horses have to earn their names," he said. "The guild trains them special. But plenty of horses still spook when chained outside in a portable circle at night. Only the ones I know won't bolt or panic get names. I bought this one in Angiers after my Garin ran off and got cored. If she makes it to Milne, I'll give her a name."
"She'll make it," Arlen said, stroking the courser's neck.
When Kieran had the mollies inside, he took her bridle and led her into the cave. As the others settled in, Arlen studied the cave mouth. Wards were chiseled into the stone, but not the floor of the entrance.
"The wards are incomplete," he said, pointing.
"Of course they are," Regan answered. "Can't ward dirt, can we?"
He looked at Arlen curiously.
"What would you do to complete the circle?" he asked.
Arlen studied the puzzle.
The mouth of the cave wasn't a perfect circle, more like an inverted U. Harder to ward, but not too hard, and the wards carved in the rock were common enough. Taking a stick, he sketched the wards in the dirt, their lines connecting smoothly with those already in place. He checked them thrice, and then slid back, looking at Regan for approval.
The messenger was silent a moment as he studied Arlen's work, then nodded.
"Well done," Reagan said, and Arlen beamed. "You plotted the vertices masterfully. I couldn't have woven a tighter web myself, and you did all the equations in your head, no less."
"Thanks," Arlen said, though he had no idea what Reagan